Okay, I guess, is there, no, it's just, okay. I'll go ahead and start. My name is Edward Gonzalez-Tennant. Today I'm talking about anarchy, ethics, and pedagogy in engaged archaeology. And so this afternoon, I would like to talk about the intersection of anarchism, ethics, and pedagogy. My investigation of anarchism as an appropriate theory for an engaged archaeology is still taking shape. This paper is based on my experience teaching a course titled Academic Activism at the University of Florida and my own attempts to create a critically engaged archaeology of redress in regards to the violent destruction of a 1920s African-American community in Florida. There are, of course, many obstacles to teaching anarchism in today's neoliberal educational environment. In my opinion, students' common misconceptions about anarchism's central goals and themes present one of the most significant educational obstacles. Oh, so that should have been up while I was saying that. These are the themes I'm going to cover most rapidly today. We'll come back. So, I routinely poll my students to gauge what the common misunderstanding of anarchism is in their minds. I do this for many reasons. It helps me to tailor my teaching materials as well as select case studies to dispel these common misconceptions. To date, I've polled 140 students representing a pretty diverse student background in terms of race, major, gender, and even nationality. Several of the responses are not surprising, but a nuanced look at them helps me understand the various starting points inherent in my classes as we explore anarchism's contribution to education and activism. This is most obvious in those definitions that offer little substance, defining anarchism as just simply bad. Actually, some of these definitions speak directly to concepts from the historical core of anthropology. For instance, one respondent simply defined anarchism as social Darwinism. Nothing else, that was his response. His or her response. Anyways. Unfortunately, I have no idea if this student considered social Darwinianism a positive, truthful, or aberrant thing. Then the familiar idea of anarchism as utopic is quoted by some students. While this response is common perhaps among some academics and philosophers of education as a critique of anarchism, it is a relatively minor popular definition among today's undergraduates. Responses in this section include, I associate it with a sense of peace, total freedom, and doing as you please with no consequences. The next grouping represents approximately a quarter of the respondents and the majority of definitions which kind of brush against the spirit of anarchism. The general revolutionary and critical tradition of anarchism is referenced by this group, and common responses include an outcry against a social power, sometimes authority needs to be challenged, and perhaps less accurate as the conflation between punk rock and anarchism. Obviously, these are not well-developed and nuanced understandings of anarchism, but they are not hostile and do not demonstrate a personal fear or societal distrust of anarchism. The association with punk rock is surely a response to popular culture. However, the next two groupings of responses together account for nearly two-thirds of all responses and represent some troubling misconceptions about anarchy. Again, the lack of government and order would seem to suggest a similarity to a chaotic society out of control. However, I've made this distinction because many of my students do so in their own responses. Responses that fall into this category include statements like libertarian, loss of private property, and no goals. The final grouping demonstrates a complete misunderstanding of anarchism, and this is the tyrannical, chaotic, and insane. I would say this demonstrates the deepest influence of the media and a more sinister form of anarchism. Common responses in this section include Sons of Anarchy, The Joker and the Dark Knight, and anarchy is crazy, chaotic, and divisive, and even freedom and liberation at their most dangerous. Also, one response from this group, again, speaks directly to our subdiscipline of archaeology and states, I don't consider prehistoric times to be related to anarchy. I don't really imagine people running around crazy with their heads chopped off. There are other developments which intersect with respondents' violence-oriented definitions of anarchism. For instance, the media hype surrounding violence among small numbers of self-identified anarchic youth groups at various national and international events And another less obvious but I think growing trend is found among hate groups like the National Anarchists, who advocate racial separatism and white racial purity. While such groups are still relatively unknown in America, they are growing. The Bay Area National Anarchists co-founder Andrew Yeoman says this about the group: "We are racial separatists for a number of reasons, such as our desire to maintain our cultural continuity, the principle of voluntary association, and as a self-defensive measure to protect each other from being victimized by crime from other races. If you consider yourself an anarchist and an activist, as I do, the development of such groups is especially troubling." And this is one instance where I do believe the role of education remains a strong and perhaps one of the most powerful ways to counter such developments. And so what does an anarchist philosophy of education look like? What are the traditional critiques? Is it significantly different from libertarian, liberal, and neoliberal forms of education? What is the value of education in anarchy? Such concerns were often addressed by anarchist thinkers in the 19th and 20th century. And this section of my paper draws heavily on Judith Suess's Anarchism and Education, a Philosophical Perspective, and her discussion specifically of these above questions. The present education system in the US, Europe, and many other places around the world is a liberal one which relies on the state and various hierarchical structures. Over the past 20 to 30 years, a new form of educational structure has slowly been taking over as our higher education institutions are increasingly corporatized. This neoliberalization of university life presents one of the greatest threats to free thought, as the university's central role increasingly revolves around the reproduction of hierarchy. Anarchism critiques such systems of oppression, but anarchist education has only been explored by a small group of scholars. Suess organizes the most common reactions against anarchism as a pedagogical stance into the following three themes. The rejection of authority by anarchists precludes a coherent theory of education. Anarchy's argument against the state goes against universal education. And how can anarchism teach non-coercively while still contributing to programs of social transformation? This first concern can be addressed as a discussion between the dominant views of liberal education. This view, among others, states that the state-sponsored education system should not advocate any single view of education's role in regards to establishing, changing, or preserving the current society. Of course, critical sociologists and critical race theorists have repeatedly demonstrated how the current educational system reproduces, preserves, and entrenches the status quo. The second point requires a knowledge of anarchism's construction of human nature. Anarchism does make positive assumptions, and most critics have essentialized these as naive and utopian. However, Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, a Factor for Revolution, draws on Darwin, as well as Kropotkin's own research with the zoologist to demonstrate anarchism's sophisticated treatment of human nature. Kropotkin saw human nature as bifurcated between selfish and altruistic impulses, and framed these two impulses in relation to the state as a selfish and guild as an altruistic thing. Ultimately, Kropotkin believed it possible that the altruistic impulses would win out in terms of human society. Likewise, Bakunin saw the development of such a society as possible only if certain conditions were met. I won't read it since it's up there. Also, Godwin's words from 1783, I think, still ring true today. So as we can see, there exists a positive core of anarchism resting upon ideas of equality and fraternity. Furthermore, differences between anarchism and libertarianism demonstrate the uniqueness of the former, this being another critique of anarchism dealing with the perceived conflict between individualism and the community. However, this critique stems from a misrepresentation stating how anarchism has privileged the individual at the cost of all else. I'm on track. All right. Once again, anarchist philosophers themselves undermine these critiques. Now I'd like to turn to Suess's third point and how I've addressed it in my own teaching experience. Just how difficult is the creation of a non-coercive, socially liberating pedagogy? The majority of scholars who talked about this point discuss the anarchist and near-anarchist schools that appeared in Europe and US during the 20th century. These discussions highlight how neighborhoods and local communities in the past addressed the educational needs of their children. Philip Gardner, in his 84 book, The Lost Elementary Schools of Victorian England, concluded that such working class did achieve these sorts of communal desires in all sorts of important ways. Additionally, some schools which appeared anarchist have in fact been libertarian. So for instance, the Summerhill School in Suffolk, England is an important example in differentiating between what an anarchist school might look like and what a libertarian school does look like. When the state threatened to close down Summerhill for not meeting basic educational guidelines, the school responded by becoming increasingly insular and wary of those families who were not involved in the school. Such a stance goes against, I think, a fundamental anarchist tendency to engage with the state, hierarchies, and anything that limits the ability of individuals and communities to self-organize in beneficial ways. So I've approached the idea of creating a non-coercive, socially liberating form of pedagogy in a number of ways. First, I use modern texts that objectively, or at least faithfully, introduce the core concepts of anarchism to my student. The central text I've drawn on is Graeber's Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology. It's nice because it's online as a PDF, so they don't have to buy it. Students like me. Since my academic activism course is offered by an anthropology department, I find this text a good introduction in terms of anarchism, but specifically as an introduction to the close relationship between our parent discipline of anthropology and anarchism, particularly in the early 20th century. Graeber's text is particularly useful because it introduces anarchism as a theory of ethical action in the real world. And additionally, I find Graeber's call to investigate the university itself of particular interest. It is in line with Angela Jancius' project of confronting the neoliberalization of university life, which I think is a useful project. However, Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology offers little specific guidance in regards to creating a non-coercive educational environment. In order to do this, I draw on the works of Bell Hooks, and particularly her teaching to transgress education as a practice of freedom. For Hooks, creating an engaged pedagogy means that teachers, and this is a quote, means that teachers must actively be committed to a process of self-actualization that promotes their own well-being if they are to teach in a manner that empowers students. This means that educators need to decolonize their own minds first. Liberation is organic and polysemous, and my form of liberation will not always match the forms sought after by my students. In my opinion, the most dramatic suggestion Hooks makes in this book is when she states that a good professor must be a willing confessor. In my class, the majority of each student's grade comes from a semester project. These are independent projects that they undertake throughout the semester. I frame it as each student is to identify a social issue they feel a personal connection to. This can be a radical group, or it can be the local animal shelter, and no qualifications are placed upon the nature of the group. The only qualification for the student is that the group be real, that it meets, and is actively engaged in some form of social transformation, no matter how big or small. And as part, that engagement in society be part of the group's mission statement. Then each student engages this group as a member or a volunteer, evaluates the group's methods in relation to achieving that stated mission objectives, and delivers this critique to the class during an end-of-semester presentation. Throughout the semester, much of the course looks like a course on social movements. We examine how academics interact with the complex terrain of social activism in today's world. The semester is broken up, as such, into three sections. The first examines theoretical reasons for engaging in social transformation as an academic, and includes writings by Donna Haraway, Victoria Stanford, Arundhati Roy, bell hooks, and topical interest to critical race theory, as well as Peter Gelderloo's challenging book, How Nonviolence Protects the State. After all, as Graeber suggests, if anarchism advocates for a peaceful revolution, is there a role for violence in the complex terrain of social transformation? The second section of the course examines what I call the traditional role of academics as advocates. This section examines the ways in which academics educate ourselves, one another, and wider communities about social justice issues. The final section consists of reading ethnographies by anthropologists who at least claim to have taken their research, quote unquote, to the streets. My students have responded to this pedagogical stance in energetic and impressive ways. The first paragraph of my syllabus states plainly that the course is one where students and educators meet as socially aware equals. This little sentence attracts all sorts of students, and as a class we navigate the uneasy terrain of collaboratively running a course based on anarchist principles, including the modification of the reading list itself. This goes beyond simply setting up a seminar class and involves me serving as an emotionally sensitive facilitator. Sometimes this means revealing tender moments of my own life. Other times it involves me acting as a stern moderator so that students will have the opportunity to share similar personal experiences. The credit, of course, for creating this environment goes to everyone sitting in the classroom each day. And additionally, the discussion of Graver's and Hooke's texts, among others, signal to the students that our classroom is a place where these ideas are going to be put into practice. So, however, before this becomes a self-congratulatory piece on the success of a single course, I would like to conclude by discussing how these experiences have altered my own approaches of creating an engaged archaeology of redress with the descendant and advocate community of Rosewood, Florida. Historical archaeology subjects are often the oppressed and marginalized populations of the past, victims of direct and/or structural violence. So, as Lee Binford suggests, why haven't the various dimensions of oppression, social, economic, political, assumed a more prominent role within anthropology, for me, historical archaeology? In this, as Lee Binford suggests, a natural outcome of anthropologists as establishment products, no, sorry, is this lack, as Lee Binford suggests, a natural outcome of anthropologists as establishment products, who are disinterested in developing incisive analyses of the system that supports us? Can we challenge, let alone actively dismantle, such structures that cloud our experience with hegemonic tropes of neutrality and objectivity? These are massive questions, and the first step to answering them for me is the active participation in decolonizing myself and archaeology. As Faye Harrison suggests, such a project requires that academics create more equitable relationships with their subjects. In other words, the elimination of distancing mechanisms, of which hierarchy is one of the greatest examples. Of course, what scholars mean by engagement, however, ranges broadly. It is important to understand the terrain of engagement, and for me, anarchism, as I understand and teach it, encourages me to explore these other perspectives as well as respect each of them in turn. So Rosewood, this is my case study, is located in central Florida, 9 miles from the Gulf. By the early 20th century, Rosewood was a majority black town, while the neighboring community of Sumner was a company town with a mix of black and white workers, but still majority white. Then, on New Year's Day, 1923, a white woman in Sumner fabricates a black assailant to hide her extramarital affair with a white man. Rumor and hatred spread quickly through rural Florida, eventually reaching the Ku Klux Klan in Gainesville, only 40 miles away. By the 6th of January, at least four black men had been brutally murdered, and a white mob, now numbering in the hundreds, began the systematic burning of Rosewood. During this time, a train was brought through town at 4 in the morning, picked up women and children who had spent the previous nights hiding in the local swamps, and then took dozens of these families to towns locally like Otter Creek, Archer, and Gainesville's Black District, where descendants live to this day. Residents of Rosewood, those who survived long enough, would have to wait for more than 7 decades to receive any trace of justice. While a grand jury convened in January of 1923, no convictions were made, and the jury's records have been potentially conveniently lost. Rosewood lingered at the edges of collective memory for decades. Then in 1994, landmark decision, the state of Florida decided to pay compensation to survivors and descendants. And of course, these terminologies are really important in understanding redress and reparations activism. So race riots offer a distinct view, I think, into the past and present race relations in the United States. These events underscore the social construction of race and racism in our country, as well as illuminating race and class relations in terms of which groups possess power at the expense of other groups. Historic race riots were powerful ways of silencing black political participation, economic advancement, and social progress in the 19th and 20th centuries. Some of the worst race riots took place between 1917 and 1923, this including the Red Summer of 1919, when 78 people were lynched, 11 African-American men were burned alive at the stake, including two in Florida, and 25 riots broke out across the nation. Riots during these years were the result of numerous social, political, and economic stresses. White supremacy was flourishing again after D.W. Griffith's 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation, uniting and igniting the worst of white fears and portraying African Americans as hypersexual, deceitful, and inherently inferior. Other riots were basically labor riots between races, often orchestrated by industrialists through the introduction of minority strikebreakers. Race riots also underscore the struggle for political rights by African Americans, as whites violently obstructed political participation, and additionally, racially charged collective violence was often used to seize land from successful blacks. as what happened at Rosewood, Florida. There were hundreds of examples of this practice in the 19th and 20th centuries. And they were called white capping, for the white caps often worn by whites as they ran blacks off their land. Also, as James Lowen reminds us, these events were not restricted to African-American populations in the Deep South or alone in the Deep South. The legacy of extra-legal, racially charged collective violence is a nationwide experience. So Barbara Little has commented on how sites like the African Burial Ground can participate in the truth-telling aspects common to many truth and reconciliation commissions. While most TRCs form as a part of a national democratic transition process, some have formed locally in the U.S. The Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, created to seek justice for the 1979 murders of five activists by local Ku Klux Klan and Nazi organizations, is one example. TRCs have been typified by the South African case, where amnesty was granted to state actors in the interest of producing an accurate accounting of apartheid. While the granting of amnesty has received serious critique, it should be noted that South Africa's TRC also recommended monetary reparations to victims of apartheid as a way to combat structural inequalities. So knowledge that the capitalist nature of American society results in structural inequalities has become a prominent focus among reparations activists. While many acknowledge that current racial inequalities for African Americans derive from slavery, increasing numbers are actually fighting for Jim Crow reparations. A variety of tactics are being explored, and recently the need to educate the U.S. public about redress is motivating groups like the Black Radical Congress and Trans Africa Forum to step up their education efforts. Archaeologists can participate in this aspect of the redress movement as we politically engage the modern world. So the most common form of engagement in archaeology today is a growing commitment to producing publicly accessible material. This awareness has become foundational for public archaeology. Say next on a continuum of engagement is the movement to involve academic research in various policy processes. This type of work often takes the form of raising awareness of social injustices such as Anna Lou de Havenin's cultural anthropology work in New York City or James Davidson's historical archaeology work in Dallas. These pieces serve to inform the public of the many complex ways, and often hidden ways and hidden structures, and how they are mobilized to disenfranchise already marginalized groups. So progressing from educating to critiquing the actual systems perpetuating structural violence remains a poorly addressed form of engagement. Paul Farmer stresses that the first step is truly changing systems of oppression. The first step in changing these systems is to accurately analyze and describe such structures. His research explains how groups like the working poor result from infrastructure power, while racism and sexism result from superstructural attitudes. Archaeologists interested in this type of work tend to focus, I think, on Marxist approaches aimed at analyzing the development of ideologies of masking a social reality, projection of the present into the past, and the need for praxis in many different forms. Recently, a new activist anthropology has emerged in the past decade. This form of engagement has been framed as community-centered praxis, and it moves beyond openly acknowledging a political viewpoint towards genuinely addressing community concerns. These concerns, if we follow this new trend, will result in a transformative rewriting of our actual practice. The anthropological works by Shoa Rodriguez in Florida, as well as the archaeological work by Paul Mullins in Indiana, are examples of this approach. This approach is the most difficult to achieve, I think, because it demands academics relinquish part or all of their hierarchical status in the interest of local knowledges, practices, and concerns. For me, anarchism is a ready-made theoretical perspective which fits this new form of engagement. As a historical anthropologist, merging archaeology and engaged visual anthropology, anarchism motivates me to explore new techniques aimed at democratizing the knowledge I produce, as well as my chosen methodology. At present, a combination of new information technologies, historical research, and community engagement highlight my approach to investigating Rosewood. It remains difficult to conduct traditional archaeological work at the site. Difficult in the sense that people shoot at you when you go there. Problem. It remains difficult, and new information technologies are being drawn upon to digitally reconstruct the community. Methodologically, I draw upon an established tradition of participatory GIS and counter mapping, which is defined as the use of cartography by a group, quote, or ethnic minority to assemble data, generate maps and other geographic representations, and disseminate these materials for the purpose of better understanding a wide variety of topics expressed spatially. This includes in creating interpretive maps for tours of Rosewood today, tours, the bus drives through the town, what's left of it, which is one building. This includes creating the interpretive maps for this tour, which was one of the first requests made by the Senate community. However, we went beyond simply creating these maps, and I've spent personally many hours installing GIS software, creating tutorials, and teaching the descendant community and their advocates how to use these methods and these technologies to do the work themselves. I'm also recreating the vanished social landscape of Rosewood and its neighboring communities. This is accomplished by using GIS to map property boundaries from a historic meets and bounds description, a tedious and long task to do for a 10 square mile area. The combination of plant maps, tax records, census data from the 19th and early 20th century identifies both property owners and their renters on the landscape and produces material useful in understanding the class, gender, and kinship relations in these communities. This use of historic property data to argue for official redress represents a clear, achievable, and important contribution in seeking justice for historic wrongs, as well as a methodology which can be taught to members of the public. Additionally, oral history complicates simplistic, dichotomous stereotypes of historic North Florida communities as black and or white, and allows researchers to challenge dualism still dominant in American/Western society. Rosewood and its surrounding communities were a heterogeneous mix of white, African, Native American, as well as various non-white European minorities, such as the Irish, Greek, and Jewish communities, before they became white. These methodologies of oral history are geared towards community engagement, and many of the oral testimonies I draw upon were collected by the Rosewood families and their advocates themselves. Drawing on these multivocal data sets empowers the community as I relinquish my role as academic authority and recognize the importance of their work. Additionally, I'm constructing a number of outputs collectively titled the Virtual Rosewood Project. I don't know if you can read the website, it's unimaginatively titled virtualrosewood.com. The specific goal is to use such environments to take audience through an architecturally reconstructed landscape of the area prior to the 1923 race riot. As the documentary moves from place to place in this digitally reconstructed environment, the voices of survivors, descendants, and kin will replace the narrator and discuss their connections to the civic sites, structures, and homes encountered in the 3D documentary. This is aimed at producing a truly collaborative and literally multivocal interpretation of Rosewood, drawing on my collaboration with the descendant and advocate community. Yeah. Anarchism, for me, is a theory of ethical praxis. This theoretical perspective does not naively position the individual above the collective. Indeed, the majority of critiques and popular misconceptions were addressed by 19th and early 20th century thinkers. Additionally, anarchism provides the theoretical push to create an engaged project which goes beyond listening to the concerns of local communities. In a time when public archaeology can be conflated, and sometimes is often conflated, with CRM, and archaeologists rush forward to posture their work as in service to the local, anarchism offers us a fresh take on what it means to truly engage. This perspective is not unique to anarchist theory, and intersects with many modern and critical thinkers in immediately productive ways. Anarchism makes engagement less about the photo op, and more about eliminating academic hierarchy, which distances us from the real world. For this means democratizing my knowledge, my methods, and perhaps most importantly, my time. I do this by teaching a counter-mapping seminar at the Gainesville Free University, spending time in people's homes, and producing online tutorials that others from around the world draw upon. This does not interfere with a traditional role as an academic, and I have been able to publish on some of these experiences. I think that anarchism offers a way to create a more genuinely engaged form of archaeology, and personally I look forward to the continued explorations of this rich terrain.